Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope Benedict prays at the tomb of St. Augustine, the 5th century theologian and doctor of the Church, during a weekend visit to northern Italy. Make aid work. Catholic development agencies are calling on governments around the world to live up to their promises to the poor. And promoting best practices in prevention and care for those living with the HIV virus. Benedict XVI returned to Rome on Sunday evening after a two-day pastoral visit to the cities of Vigevano and Pavia in northern Italy, during which he paid homage to St. Augustine, one of the key figures in the early Christian Church. Born in North Africa, St. Augustine spent his life searching for truth and is considered one of history's greatest thinkers. Pope Benedict himself was greatly influenced by this saint, who died in 430. In 1953, the future pope wrote his doctoral thesis on St. Augustine, and he cites him often in his writings and speeches. Lydia O'Kane reports on the pope's weekend visit.
Pope Benedict brought his visit to a close with its highlight, praying Vespers over the tomb of St. Augustine, housed in the Basilica of San Pietro in Ciel d'Oro. In his own words, the Holy Father said that it was at this moment his visit to Pavia gained the shape of a pilgrimage. He began his homily at the celebration of Vespers by saying his journey was all he had envisaged, before going on to thank the Augustinian Order and its general prior, Father Robert Prevost, who recently spoke about the Pope's devotion to this great saint.
We were obviously aware already for many years of the great love, devotion, if you will, of Joseph Ratzinger, at that time cardinal and theologian, and today Pope Benedict.
The dominant theme of Pope Benedict's speech was one which contained three words: God is love, saying that sending his son like a victim for the atonement of our sins opened the eyes of St. Augustine.
La luce di questo amore ha aperto gli occhi di Agostino, gli ha fatto incontrare la bellezza antica e sempre nuova in cui soltanto trova pace il cuore dell'uomo.
The Holy Father then turned to his first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, God is Love, which he said in its first part drew on the thoughts of St. Augustine, who was enchanted with the love of God.
Deus caritas est, Dio è amore. Questa enciclica, soprattutto la sua prima parte, è largamente debitrice al pensiero di Sant'Agostino, che è stato un innamorato dell'amore.
He went on to say the essential message that God is love was something that contemporary humanity needed to hear, and that the young in particular needed to receive the news of the freedom and the delight whose secret is in Christ. He concluded his homily and his visit by saying that it was a true gift to be beside the tomb of St. Augustine and to share it with those present. It was a visit that had seen him earlier in the day take in the city of Pavia's university and hospital, where he said human life needed to be respected in all of its phases. It was also a day which saw him celebrate an open-air Mass before thousands of people, where he said St. Augustine was a model for Christians today. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Make aid work. The world can't wait. That's the call from an international network of Catholic aid and development agencies, which has launched a new campaign in the lead-up to the G8 summit of leaders of the richest nations in Germany this June. Philippa Hitchin has been investigating.
The campaign is calling on the governments of both wealthy countries and the developing world to take stock of how far they've come on their promises to the poor, the so-called Millennium Development Goals drawn up at the United Nations in the year 2000. These include the goals of halving the numbers of people living in poverty, cutting child mortality rates, and facilitating access to education and healthcare by the year 2015.
These Millennium Development Goals, the MDGs, are also important because they are politically feasible. They are not utopian. We're not saying we will wipe out poverty by the year 2015. We're saying that there are various steps that we can make, both in the so-called rich countries and in the so-called poor countries, to achieve these goals of cutting poverty in half and by making sure that every school child goes at least to primary school.
Duncan McLaren is Secretary General of Caritas Internationalis, one of the two main organisers of this campaign.
And now we are nearly halfway through, and so we think it's time to take stock of where we are with those promises. But it's very clear that at the current speed, the MDGs will not be achieved by the year 2015. And therefore, just as with the debt campaign and the Jubilee debt campaign, we need to mobilise the public to put pressure on their politicians. And in this case, especially before the G8 summit in June, which will be in northern Germany. And this campaign is part of that mobilisation. We see this as a window of opportunity to remind politicians of their solemn promise to the poor, and we want them to give a progress report on the commitments that they made in 2005 in Gleneagles in Scotland.
We want to see the figures, and we want to see the projections also, how they are going to progress after the G8 on aid, on debt relief.
Christiane Overkampf is Secretary General of CIDSE, the other main partner behind this new initiative. She told me why it's vital for both church leaders and ordinary lay people to be involved in this campaign.
So we'll have one focus about involving ordinary citizens in North and South in the campaign, and they are invited to write postcards to the G8. And to in particular Germany as hosting the G8. And on the other hand also, citizens in Africa and Asia and Latin America will approach their own governments to make aid work for poor people in those countries. So that's one side of the campaign. And the other side of the campaign is about church leaders from Africa, Asia and Latin America and G8 countries. And they are going to form a delegation under the leadership of Cardinal Rodriguez from Honduras, and they are going to visit G8 leaders in May in the run-up to the G8. So they are going to visit Germany, they are going to see German government officials, the German vice chancellor, for example, or most probably also the German finance minister. They are going to go to the UK, they are going to see the British government, they're going to go to Italy, and they are going to raise the voice of the Catholic Church on the same subject matter that we are concerned that aid should work for the poor.
How important do you think the church involvement is overall in this campaign? You mentioned, for example, the importance of the church in the Jubilee campaign back in 1999. Do you think, again, the church can have a really crucial role in changing attitudes and in pushing these ministers to making a difference?
Yeah, I'm really convinced that could be the case. So if we look at the example of the Jubilee campaign, then I think it's clear that it was the contribution of the Catholic and the Protestant Church jointly that brought about the change. If you look at the signatures being collected in the Jubilee campaign, the vast majority of them came from Catholic and Protestant constituencies, but also the kind of ethical imperative that the Church brings and that also this time the bishops and cardinals will express, I think this impresses upon politicians. And I think also the long tradition that the Church has on working, on fighting poverty really on the ground, the knowledge of the reality of the poor on the ground, but also our own credibility in and working towards change. So we are not just asking the governments to do something, but we are taking our share of that. And I think all that together makes that I think the voice of the church, the voice of the lay and the voice of bishops and cardinals has been listened to in those circles. I'm truly convinced, yeah.
As you well know, there are those who say the MDGs are impossible. We will never achieve these goals by the year 2015. You clearly don't share that view.
I mean, if progress is going to continue as it continues now, we'll not reach them. That's clear. But at the same time, I think they are realistic goals that has been calculated. When they were set in the beginning, governments have calculated whether this is realistic and they have made their projections and they were realistic. I mean, they are still far below what we would ask for, you know. We are about eradicating poverty, so having poverty cannot be anything that we are satisfied with. But I think having poverty by 2015 is realistic, but only if massive steps are going to be taken now. If not, we'll not see that happening, and millions of people will suffer from that.
Make aid work. But just how effectively does development aid money work in countries where governments are weak, corruption is rife, and rural communities are often isolated and cut off from essential health or education services?
If development aid and debt relief is focused on poverty reduction, it can make a big difference.
Paul Samangasu is Africa representative on the Caritas Internationalis Advocacy Committee and was involved in the monitoring of government development spending in his own country, Cameroon. He says many other African nations have also made important steps towards poverty reduction through debt relief and other development aid mechanisms.
In Zambia, an umbrella group of 100 citizens' organizations monitor and comment on their government spending decisions. Through this kind of participation, Zambians have succeeded in increasing the proportion of money allocated to poverty reduction from 30% to 60% of the Zambian budget. Increased spending on district hospitals and clinics and provisions of medicines have helped to bring about falls in infant mortality and malaria, and an increased awareness of HIV/AIDS. Even though the public consultation is not perfect, it is definitely a step in the right direction. Improvements in agriculture, health, and education can all be attributed to people having a say on how aid money was spent. In Uganda, aid increases led to an increase of primary school enrollment from 3 million children in 1997 to nearly 8 million in 2003. In South Africa, a measles vaccination campaign reduced the number of cases from 66,000 in 1996 to 117 in 2000. In Tanzania, increased aid has enabled government to double spending on education between 1999 and 2003. While these are a few examples, we can draw some important lessons for other countries as well. First, citizens and civil society organizations must have a say on how money is spent. Second, governments must be fully transparent about how they spend the money. Third, governments must be accountable to their citizens and not primarily to the donors. And fourth, governments have to fight corruption on all levels of administration and the private sector. We must hold our leaders responsible in rich and poor countries for how the additional funds are being used. Are they being used in the best possible way for the people? Are the people involved in decisions? Are the funds being used in a transparent way? These are the things we have to hold our governments accountable for in the north and in the south.
Do you see it more important to make progress here on the G8 countries, or do you see the campaign that is going on at the same time in the developing countries as actually more important to make this work, to really get the money going to where it's most needed?
I would say that's equally important. You know, I think if there are no resources and no additional resources being made available, and that is very much a responsibility of donor countries, of the G8 and other donor countries, then I cannot see the progress happening, because then just the resources will not be there to be spent on health and education and other things that are urgently needed to reach the MDGs. But at the same time, if governments in southern countries do not take their responsibility, if money there is not being spent on poverty, if it's going into private pockets, if it's going into projects that are not really helping the fight against poverty, then also we will not see a change. So I think it's two sides of the same coin, and they are equally important. So that's why we have that campaign that involves people in the north and in the south. And we don't find it sufficient to just approach the G8 or just approach southern governments, but it needs to be done at the same time and with the same pressure, I'd say.
Just tell us, if you can, what you're hoping to achieve by this summit, concrete goals that you would like to see at the outcome of this summit in Germany, the G8 meeting in Germany.
Well, I think, on the one hand, I think if the G8 would really have a thorough debate and a thorough focus on poverty reduction, that would already be an achievement. And if it would not be only focused on the northern agenda and the northern self-interest in terms of economic development or energy security or whatever might be on that agenda. And then I think one of the things that we'd really like to see is a serious stock take of where they are in implementing the commitments to the MDGs, but it also in implementing the very concrete commitments they have made at the Gleneagles Summit 2 years ago in 2005. So we want to see the figures, and we want to see the projections also, how they are going to progress after the G8 on aid, on debt relief. Well, and I think that would already be quite something if they would do a serious stock take there. Yeah.
A very practical question. Yeah. Catholics, people who want to become involved in this campaign, what do they do? Where do they go?
Where do they go? So they can visit the CIDSE or the Caritas website, so CIDSE.org, and there they will find a link to this campaign, and they can download appeals and postcards and get more information. So that's a very concrete way of getting involved, and they can get postcards, and they can start sending those postcards. But people can also become part of an online gallery where they can have stand-ups carrying banners, make aid work, and people from all over the world will register, and we will work with that also then with the G8 and with the media. So that's another way of being part of that.
And just to remind you of what the Church says, one of the most recent statements from the Church was Archbishop Laiolo, representing the Holy See, who spoke at the UN General Assembly last September. And he said that the fulfilment of the MDGs were necessary to correct the fundamental inequalities in the world economic system. And that would mean advancing a moral alternative to war or terrorism, because the dehumanizing poverty that we have in our world and the so-called war on terrorism are intimately linked. That building peace for tomorrow requires doing justice today. And today we are calling on our Catholic constituency, the Catholics throughout the world, to participate in this campaign to do justice now.
Duncan McLaren there, the Secretary General of Caritas Internationalis. And earlier you heard Paul Samangasu, Africa Representative on the Caritas Advocacy Committee, and Christiana Overkamp, Secretary General of CIDSE.
Tackling the HIV/AIDS pandemic remains one of the world's most pressing public health challenges, and something which should concern us all. That was the message from the organisers of the annual World AIDS Day, marked each year on December the 1st, to underline the urgent need for prevention, treatment and care of individuals, families and communities living with this disease. Some 40 million people around the world are now infected by the HIV virus, with numbers of infections continuing to rise dramatically in Asia and Eastern Europe, as well as sub-Saharan Africa. Philippa Hitchin has been talking to one of the Catholic Church's top experts on prevention and care for those living with the pandemic.
We need to remind ourselves as people of faith that we have an obligation to love our neighbors as ourselves, and especially to give preferential priority to those who are the poorest and the most vulnerable. And so we need to stick with our commitment to do more for people living with HIV and AIDS, and then to eliminate the further spread of the pandemic.
Father Bob Vitillo is a special advisor on HIV/AIDS for the Global Catholic Aid and Development Confederation, Caritas Internationalis. He's worked on this issue for over two decades, with churches in countries all over the world, trying to raise awareness, combat stigma, and draw up practical help and support programs for communities devastated by the disease. Father Bob's most recent project has involved a new study to promote some of the best practices already being promoted by churches in the Southern African region.
Well, the study was to see how the church in Southern Africa has responded to the situation of HIV and AIDS, which of course is catastrophic in that area. And I studied specifically the role of the Southern African Catholic Bishops' Conference, and felt that they took a very key role because, first of all, they were able to work with more than 140 local and national organizations of the Catholic Church to be able to broker support from organizations in Europe and North America, but then also with some of the larger international organizations as well, to be able to channel this support to those organizations. The SACBC also then built the capacity of those smaller organizations and got them ready to do more and more sophisticated work in this area. Some of them started out on a very small level of simply giving social support or some visiting of people in their homes. And now a number of those have moved on then to doing antiretroviral medication programs. And my hypothesis in the study is that then this situates them much better to scale up the response to HIV and AIDS in that area.
Now, of course, South Africa is one of the worst affected countries in the world. How much is this action on by the church really keeping pace with the increasing number of infections, the increasing need of people there?
Well, the action has certainly grown, the action by the church, and also the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference commissioned a number of independent studies to evaluate their work, and these studies overwhelmingly said that it was really the work of the church that was bringing the medication programs and care and support programs to the most rural, the most isolated areas, and that they were reaching out to the poorest of the poor.
And how much is this church work going hand in hand with government programs in the different countries where the figures continue to rise?
Well, in South Africa, there's a lot of collaboration between the provincial health district offices and the work of the church. And for example, one particular program in Johannesburg refers some of its patients to the local hospital, but then many of the people that they are trying to care for are refugees and immigrants who have no rights to treatment from the South African government. And so there's a real collaboration back and forth in doing this work. In other countries, there is collaboration between the church programs and the governmental offices. But one of the problems that we face is that while the churches, not only Catholic, but other churches as well, while they provide sometimes the majority of the services, they receive very little money, either from the government itself or from some of the international funding mechanisms, such as the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria.
What can we do about this? As you say, the church does provide such a vast quantity of health care, but a lot of this goes unrecorded in some way and therefore doesn't receive the funding that it needs. What else can we do about that?
Well, a number of things. One, first of all, is that we need to do a better job at preparing our proposals for this kind of funding. We also need to do a better job as the church to evaluate the work we do in a way that then we could communicate the effects of our work in a much clearer and more scientifically based way. Sometimes people working on the ground say, I'm too busy taking care of people, I can't do those kinds of things. But unless we are scientific in our approach, then we can't really make a good case for receiving more money. Then I think we need to put more pressure on the governments in the South, to whom the money is being channeled, but also on governments in the North who are providing a lot of this money, so that they begin to take into account the contribution of faith-based organizations to the fight against AIDS.
Another area where the church is providing a vital contribution is to the vast numbers of AIDS orphans, the children who are themselves taking care of other children in that Southern African region.
Yes, this is a very key and important area. There are now estimates saying that there are about 18 million orphans due to AIDS in the world, and the vast majority of those, probably 95% of those, are in Africa. And there are a number of things that we need to do. First of all, we need to be sure that these children have the basic support that they need. Many of them are in child-headed households, and so they need some outside support from adults, role models. Be sure that they have food, be sure that they're able to go to school, and providing the funds for them to go to school. All of these are things that the church is doing. And yet more and more children are winding up on the streets. Some of them are winding up in the guerrilla movements. Some of them are winding up being trafficked into prostitution. So there's a great, great need for us to respond more carefully to the needs of those who are orphans.
And even if the figures of infections start dropping or start declining, this kind of problem among the children of the region is going to have a vast effect for years to come, isn't it?
Absolutely. Even when more people who are getting onto the antiretroviral medications are living longer, and that's a very good thing for them, and yet still there may not be enough money within the family for their children, the affected children, to be able to continue their education. For those who are not on the medications, when the parents are sick, very often the children have to stay home to take care of their parents, and they then experience a number of losses within the family, including a great loss in income into the family and insufficient food in the family. So the impact of this problem is going to continue, and it will go from one generation to the next.
I've asked you this question before, but I'll ask you again. You've been working in this area for so long, and yet we continue to see these figures rising. We continue to see millions of children with an entire future at risk. What is it that manages to give you hope? What is it that gives you inspiration to keep on with this work?
What gives me hope is to be able to go out into the field and to talk to the people affected by AIDS, the ones who say it's because of what the church has done that I am still alive and that my family is being supported in some way, and especially to talk to those church workers who are doing the on-the-ground work each and every day. And then a study like I just did in Southern Africa gives me a great deal of hope, because I know that without the intervention of the church in that area, there would be many, many more millions of people dying each year.
And my thanks there to Father Bob Vitillo, Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS for the Global Catholic Aid and Development Confederation, Caritas Internationalis.
And that's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.